You are tuned in to a Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. Join us now on another exciting metaphysical journey. Relax, tune in, drop out, and take a seat by the fire as we explore new realms and possibilities. This is Magenta Pixie. You can find me at magentapixie.weebly.com. But now, here is Zany Mystic and guest. Enjoy the show.
Good evening, and welcome to A Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. I'm your host, Lance White. Tonight, I'm delighted to have Bruce Rawls return to the show. Bruce has studied geometry, pattern, and form to uncover its deeper implications and symbolism since the early 1970s. In 1992, after taking a workshop on sacred geometry by Greg Braden, Bruce fulfilled his dream and recorded sound and music in the Great Pyramid on an Egyptian tour led by Braden. Greg also had a catalytic effect of rekindling Bruce's enthusiasm for sacred geometry, which ultimately developed into the book Sacred Geometry Design Sourcebook. Bruce is working on his second book, The Geometry Code. So let's welcome Bruce back to the show now. And hi, Bruce. How are you?
Hi, Lance. And thanks for having me on again.
Oh,
really appreciate it. It's always fun.
I can always talk to you. I learned so much from you. I feel so ignorant about geometry, sacred geometry, that it's like almost like a class.
Well, it's actually really simple. I mean, you can get into the math and really get involved in that, but in a sense, it's not necessary. In fact, sometimes it can be just a distraction from the deeper meaning that we all can grok or, you know, derive from just paying attention to what simple shapes mean on a more universal level. That's why I kind of like to stress the universal qualities, because they really are universal symbols. And as we talked about a few weeks ago, the forms even aren't really. Here I'm going to start off with a sort of a heretical, blasphemous statement. That,
oh, good.
The forms themselves really aren't the important thing. It's really the meaning that we ascribe to them that's more significant. Huh. And even beyond that is, the underlying unity or oneness that we all share, that is kind of the meaning behind the meaning, if you will. So,
and then there's meaning behind that meaning and meaning behind that meaning.
Yeah, actually a few years ago I was doing some process improvement consulting for the Air Force, and I was studying and sharing the Asian technique of the five whys that Toyota put together in like their manufacturing operations. But it's interesting because, for example, you can look at the well, why do you do this? And then you ask that question, and you get usually a surface-level answer, and then you ask a little deeper question, well, why do we do that? And if you keep asking and kind of get the intention behind that, you can get to the meaning behind the meaning, and ultimately it all resolves down to, we're here to, forgive the illusion and go home to the oneness that we all share. And there's so many different ways to describe that, but I think when we are tuning into that deepest part of ourselves, we come up with something that, words fail, of course, but, something resembles that kind of quality.
Wow. Yeah. Well, that gets pretty deep.
Well, but we are. I mean, that's what we are. The superficial stuff is really just the backdrop or the hologram that, we hang out in, and we think that's our lives. The kind of the cliche of, spiritual beings having a human experience. Well, it's really true. I mean, that's why I think that this geometric symbols can be guideposts or mnemonics or signs for, gently guiding us back to that thought system that brings us to a point of healing what appears to be separation.
Now, does sacred geometry tie into the archetypes as well that Jung kind of made popular?
Oh, sure. And I think, you can look at, for example, the 12 signs of the zodiac.
Oh, yeah.
And that would be analogous to the 12 faces on a dodecahedron, which is one of the Platonic solids that I've done some art with. And so many other people who've studied sacred geometry can relate to the idea that there's all these archetypes. There's the four elements, and then within that there's the triplicity of the three times the four of the 12. And there's a whole bunch of other systems, too. But the idea, I think, behind archetypes, again, is what happens when you integrate the wisdom of each of those? You come to, well, metaphorically, to use a what would appear on the surface to be a religious metaphor, but really isn't, the Christ principle and the 12 disciplines or the 12 disciples, you know, the 12 signs of the zodiac, that kind of thing. Each individually off on a tangent is incomplete, but when you integrate the qualities that have to do with finding the commonality, then you discover that that integrity exists within all of us, and that's what we're here to not only experience or to, you know, to learn, but to experience and to demonstrate.
Well, it certainly seems like we're in a fragmented state now, and that some people refer to that as being an veiled consciousness. This also relates most likely to the idea that we are consciousness with a pinpoint focus on our five senses, which detract or take us out of the largeness that we are.
Yeah, I like to think that one of the things I've really gotten enthusiastically back into studying this last couple of years is A Course in Miracles, and that's largely due to a couple of wonderful books by Gary Renard, Disappearance of the Universe and Your Immortal Reality. I had the pleasure of seeing Gary again this last weekend, in fact, in San Francisco. I went to a conference that was hosted there by a couple of really fun folks in San Francisco that have the Community Miracle Center, and they apparently every 2 years, I didn't know about this until just, you know, about a year and a half ago, and I saw this and said, oh, I'm supposed to be there. So I carpooled down with a friend of mine who lives here in Southern Oregon, and we had a great time. My friend Mike, shout out to him if he's listening, made these cards that are from Gary's books, The Disappearance of the Universe and Your Immortal Reality, and he read those quotes that he derived from his books, and all the way down from here in the Medford area to San Francisco,
and
we talked about them all the way down, and we listened to the audio transcripts of the book on the way back. So we had an immersion experience, and it was just wonderful. There were about 400 people there, and we got to, in addition to hearing a wonderful presentation by Gary, and he's a great joke teller, by the way.
Oh, good.
We also heard from folks like Tomas Vieira, Nuke Sanchez, and in fact, they use a metaphor that I really liked in the workshop they gave as part of the weekend. Is the dashboard of the new cars has a lot of them have the GPS instrumentation, and I'm sure most of your listeners are familiar with what GPS does. Is, you know, allows you to wherever you are, use satellite data in real time to pinpoint with incredible accuracy where you are on the planet and use that for navigation purposes. Well, the metaphor that Tomas gave at one of his presentations I thought was brilliant was our inner guidance, our conscience, inspiration, muse, whatever you want to call it, higher self, true self, Holy Spirit is what the Course in Miracles uses. The words really don't matter, but that feeling, quality that allows us to disconnect from the attachment to the outside world, not necessarily tune it out because, you know, our sensory data is there for a reason. But that's kind of like looking out the window of the plane or the car, whereas, and it can be deceiving. Because you can, for example, when I was getting a pilot's license years ago, one of the things you need to do to get your initial license just even a single instrument rating is you have to spend some time what's called flying under the hood. And the idea of that is the instruments, the internal instruments on the cockpit, on the dashboard, so to speak, of your vehicle, give you far more accurate information than what appears to be going on outside. It doesn't mean you don't pay attention to what's going on outside, but that knowing that information can be misleading will get you on the right track. And to me, that's a metaphor for one of the laws we talked about last time of the Hermetic laws, of which there are seven. The one I was thinking of is the law of cause and effect, and cause being what we have access to internally, regardless of what's going on outside, allows us to tap into that knowingness, that very peaceful, serene quality that says, okay, if I follow this guidance, I can get where I need to go. And that's where the GPS metaphor comes in, is you can look at your intuition and your higher knowing, what again, the words don't really matter, but that quality of peacefulness that says, okay, what I'm supposed to be doing next is X or Y or Z.
Uh-huh.
And when we try to, you know, short circuit that or to use the dashboard metaphor, you know, kind of put tape over the lights on the dash, you know, say, I don't want to pay attention to that, you're not going to. Then we're you know, essentially taking the long way around instead of the direct route. And that the GPS, I think, is such a great metaphor because regardless of where we are, it will tell us what is the most direct route to get to our goal. And the goal in this case is that state of pure non-duality that we're all working toward, of letting go of the whole notion of separation altogether.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, to get there, the best way to do that is, you know, we can call it by various words, but I think forgiveness is a hugely effective word for that. And that comes about by not necessarily denying what appears to be outside, but just more overlooking it or looking beyond.
Mm.
And so to use the GPS metaphor again, if we're following the instructions where it says turn right now, turn left now, you know, and take this exit, that's the quickest way because it has it all mapped out for us. But if we overshoot, in this workshop last week, and I really like the metaphor, is if we overshoot, the GPS doesn't say, "Oh, you jerk!" You know, it just, you know, calmly, nonchalantly says, "Well, you know, now the next at where you're at now, the next best, you know, exit or turn is going to be this one."
Right.
There's no judgment. There's no blame or shame or sin, that kind of stuff. All that stuff is just basically diversionary tactics that our ego uses to try to keep us from getting home quicker.
Wow, that's very clear.
Yeah,
that's really a clear statement.
Yeah, I think that's a great metaphor. And,
yeah.
And invariably, the language that our internal dashboard uses is the language of feeling.
Mm.
That when we are in a peaceful state, when we are joyous and there's no feeling of inner constriction, that's when we're forgiving what appears to be and allowing what is truly the eternal part of us to, well, it's not even really part, it's really all of us. to not deny what appears, but to overlook it. And the overlooking, I like to use the example, to grab another metaphor. Has everybody seen the magic eye books? Those, what they call stereograms. It's basically these patterns. If you haven't seen them, I saw one first in a shopping mall, big posters years ago. And I thought, well, what's that? And then somebody says, it's a stereogram. Well, I thought, well, what's that? And then usually they have like a little border with some stuff around it. But the main part of it is this sort of random-looking pattern of dots and lines and squiggles. And, and when you look at it within a two-dimensional perspective, it doesn't look like much of anything.
Yeah.
It's sort of this random, chaotic-looking, not even really a pattern. But what happens is that when you look beyond that, or metaphorically add another dimension, your stereoscopic vision kicks in, and you realize that there's actually information there that it's been there all along, but you overlooked. And I think that's such a great metaphor for the fact that we have within us the internal ability to perceive, not so much in a visual way, but in an internal way, the quality that shows that there's some information and some guidance no matter where we're at, no matter what we're doing. I have one in the back of my little Sacred Geometry Design source book that I put in there. It's an example of six what's called stellated dodecahedra.
Okay.
Which is a fancy word for that 12-sided shape with pentagonal points or pyramids sticking out from them.
Oh, okay.
And so if anybody has a copy of my book out there, just happens to have one. Toward the back of the book, there's a stereogram. And if you look past the page about 3 or 4 inches and let your eyes, you know, kind of gently focus down the page, but looking past it, if you will, then those six objects just all of a sudden pop out at you. It's like, whoa! So if anybody's seen a stereogram and knows what I'm referring to, you'll know what I mean.
Wow.
And I think that's kind of a neat metaphor. I think the last time we talked, we might have mentioned the flatland metaphor.
Yes, I can't hear that enough times.
Yeah. Well, it ties in really nicely because, you know, we think we're here in three-dimensional space-time, you know, 3D space and one dimension of time. And interestingly enough, as a quick aside, there's a particles called tachyons.
Right.
And if I remember correctly, they have three time dimensions and one space dimension.
Okay.
I don't know exactly what that means, but I thought it was cool.
Well, it is.
But
it sounds tacky to me.
Yeah. those are the things that travel faster than the speed of light, supposedly. Yeah.
Well,
but
the,
if I remember, again, I'm not a physicist, but I love to take the metaphysical take-home lessons from the physics and apply them, you know, liberally to our lives.
Oh, absolutely.
But years ago, there was a fellow that wrote this book called Flatland, Edwin. Trying to say Hubble, but that's not right. It's something like that. I'll think of the name. Anyway, this classic book, I think it's about 100 years ago, quite a few decades ago anyway. And in it, he shows this little imaginary place where people are constrained to two dimensions.
Huh.
And they call them Flatlanders, right? So in a sense, we're kind of like Flatlanders. And if you were to take a plane or a piece of paper that, say, these Flatlanders lived on and pass a pencil through there, they would think, oh, my gosh, I'm hallucinating, because all of a sudden they'd see this black dot, and it would get bigger and bigger, and pretty soon it would be a brown circle, and then it would be a yellow hexagon. And then finally, after some time, after the prankster in 3D finished pushing it through the paper, it would look like a little pink circle when the eraser was going through, and then it would disappear. And, you know, the people in Flatland would, you know, rush off to the nearest two-dimensional phone to call National Flatland Inquirer, whatever the equivalent would be, right? And say, I just had this incredible hallucination or, you know mystical experience, and, you know, I saw this shape going through my reality. And we do the same thing. I mean, we have dreams and we have visions and occasionally epiphanies of one sort or another. And, you know, we make a big deal out of it because we're so used to convincing ourselves that our sensory data is, you know, the real McCoy.
Yeah.
And yet we see this tiny little fragment of reality, and we make, you know, such a big special deal out of it. That's another word in the Course in Miracles I like. It talks about special love and special hate relationships. That, you know, we make all these, you know, bargains with reality, or we try to,
yeah,
to make the illusion real. And we basically say my little corner of space time is more important than some other little corner of space time. And if your listeners have seen the movie The Powers of Ten, you can do a Google search on the web and find it.
Oh yeah, that's well worth looking at.
It's a great little film,
and
you zoom in from the outermost stretch where galaxies are just little specks, and then finally they become bigger, and you zoom down through galaxies into clusters of stars, and then finally down to planet Earth, and then you zoom into a cell in a person's hand or whatever it is, and down to the DNA molecule, and finally to the quark level, and we realize we have this tiny, tiny fragment of, even in the 3D, what we call reality, perspective upon which to draw from.
Yeah.
And
okay.
We occupy this, maybe 6 feet of that out of probably, maybe not an infinite amount of space, but a whole lot more than we usually are aware of. And then if we take good care of ourselves, we might, you know, last a century, you know, out of how many millennia going backwards and forwards through the illusion of time, you know.
Right.
And yet we think that we've got it all figured out, and yet, you know, at best, we have a minuscule fragment of a hallucination of a shadow of a reflection of reality.
Yes, it's pretty scary, isn't it?
Well, it's humbling, and at the same time, I think it's empowering when we realize that the only way out of it is to let go of the separation, and to do that by working with each other and with the spirit of each other. And I think that the idea of forgiveness really is crucial to that, because it provides us with the mechanism by which we can let go of the grievances that we think we have of thinking, oh, I'm stuck in this little part of space-time, and I've got to, you know, like the beer ads, you know, grab for all the gusto I can get, you know. It's like
that seems to be what people have been doing for about the last 100 years.
Well, probably more than that, I would say.
Well, maybe a few thousand millennia.
Yeah, like maybe since time started.
Right, exactly, the fight for survival.
Yeah.
But, of course, the most important aspect of this in forgiveness, because you can't forgive anyone else until you've forgiven yourself.
Exactly.
And doesn't that seem to be the hard part is, first of all, being able to see one's own part and take responsibility for what one has created.
Exactly.
And move out of victim and blame mode.
Right. And I think that the crucial thing, and one thing that I think Gary Renard's work, I'm coming back to that in the Course in Miracles because I think they're brilliant works, that really distilled that for me, which I've been studying this stuff off and on since the mid-80s, and it just kind of, how I missed this crucial concept the first few times through, that if the universe is to be consistent, what we would call the creator or God couldn't have anything to do with space-time. Because then he would just be, you know, as the story goes, you know, involved in, you know, the story told by an idiot, you know. Because if we were to try to make what changes real, then the eternal, forever true qualities of what we are, which is really the love, the kindness, the gratitude, all those what we call positive qualities, would be bogus. So what the Course spells out really beautifully is either the thought system that says that we're real and we're all one being and we're all independent of space-time despite appearances is true, or the thought system that says everything is totally wacko and insane is true, and never the twain shall meet.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that you know we need to ignore what appears to be going on around us, because we can certainly do the things that we need to do in the material world to, you know, just our everyday stuff. But it's not about changing the effect, it's about changing the cause. And that's brought about by looking at the feelings that we have about things and saying, oh, do I want to hang on to this grievance, or can I look at the fact that because this is such a fleeting thing, that it really can't be true, and therefore it's a dream, a projection. In the same way that you go to the theater, I mean, if you have issues with the movie, throwing shoes and tomatoes at the screen is not going to be very effective.
But
we do that, but we can laugh at that, but we do that in our lives.
Constantly.
When we try to make the world better, it's like saying, oh, I'm going to do dream remodeling.
Right.
I'm going to remodel the dream.
Right.
Remodel the hologram, you know, and you know, try to use duct tape and baling wire and maybe holodeck stain, right?
Yeah.
Because it really is kind of like a holodeck that, you know, we watch the Star Trek episodes with a holodeck, you know. What a great metaphor, because we're making this up as we go along. And if we get hung up in what appears to be, it's no different really than looking at a hologram, a very, albeit a very sophisticated one, that our seemingly split minds have conjured up, but it's just a hologram. And when we look at it that way, it's like it takes all the sting out of it, takes all the blame and shame and egoic crap out of it, because it's just like the GPS again. There's no you know, guilt associated with the idea of an error that's just like, oh, well, this isn't very effective. You just turn here now since you've overshot that exit or whatever. And I think we can do the same thing when we look at what's going on in our lives and say, oh, yeah, I don't really need to be all upset about X, Y, or Z, whether it's our finances or our health or relationships or, you know, you name it. You fill in the blanks with anything that appears to be going on in our wonderful little storybook hologram lives, you know. And I think it's helpful to look at it that way and laugh at ourselves, not laugh at the eternal being that we are, but to just kind of chuckle a little bit as how caught up we get on our own little dramas, and we say, oh, this is such a big deal. And then when we really step back and look at it, it's like, this is nothing.
Yeah.
You know, and it's I think that sense of humor that actually runs through, you know, the really deep mystical teachings when seen in that light from that thought system that says, I'm an eternal being. We all are, and ultimately we're all one. We just have this experience that we're separate. And that gives us the fuel for undoing what appears to be by forgiving, in two ways. I think two very important ways is one is it diminishes the illusion or the fantasy, if you will, the hallucination of space-time as being it. You know, the thing.
Right.
And because of that, if you get rid of space and time and you're left with here and now, then there's no other. So, A, there's no one out there to have to forgive. And B, if time is bogus, then all the things that appeared to have happened, if we kind of think back of something that happened a day ago and then a week ago and then a year ago and then 10 or 20 years ago, and it's like, oh my gosh, where is that? Well, if it's not an eternal thing, then how could it truly exist in the cosmic scheme of things?
Mm.
And if we can begin to adopt that kind of perspective, where the things that happen in space-time are just a big holographic facade that we made up, and we don't have to take quite so seriously, then we realize that there's nothing to forgive and no one to forgive.
Mm.
And then it becomes kind of fun.
Well, of course...
Granted, it takes a lot of practice, but that's what we have plenty of time for, right?
Well, yeah. It begs the question, and at least in the sci-fi movies, they can say, okay, holodeck off.
Right, right.
And they're in their reality, but we seem to be stuck in the hologram, and we haven't figured out the off switch yet to get ourselves home.
I think you just answered the question, though. You said, seem to be.
Yeah.
And it's that perspective, that awareness, and you touched on consciousness.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's a crucial thing, because if we start identifying with the dreamer of the dream rather than the dream, that's a crucial distinction. And if we say, oh, wait a minute, who is the one having these thoughts, as my friend Leonard Lasko likes to say. He's another dear friend and a local teacher who does wonderful workshops. So I'll put a little plug for his website. It's at lasko.net.
Okay,
and,
good.
His one of the workshop exercises that I really love that he does is, he asks, well, who is it that's having these thoughts? And then if you can ask that question, it brings back to the awareness, the wholeness that we are, the idea that we're a being that is not separate from anything else, and we're the awareness that appears to be having the experience. But like so many of the mystics are keep trying to gently remind us, we're not the experience
right. That's
happening outside of us.
Right.
That's just part of the movie. We're in the theater and we're watching this thing,
and
we made it up, and we forgot that we were the product. Producers, directors, actors, choreographers, and everybody else. The best boys and the gaffers and all the whole...
We're the whole thing.
All the credits, they're all us. Yeah.
And that's, that we're multidimensional, so we're
exactly.
Not only in this this aspect of whatever, the illusion or hologram, we might be in millions of other holograms.
Exactly, yeah. Because if you take space-time out of it, then that kind of compresses everything from reincarnation to multiple dimensions and realities into back to that oneness again, or the point of the center of the sphere, the circle in geometry, or the crux of the cross, or the single point that balances the rhythm of the yin yang, or the meanders, or the spirals, and to use some geometric metaphors.
Well, so let's kind of explore a little bit. It seems that we're at kind of a turning point as a collective.
Uh-huh.
And the planet is at a turning point, or many turning points, maybe. Maybe there's a lot of these different timelines separating out.
Uh-huh.
How do you see all that playing out, and is there... it seems like I'm being bombarded with 2012 information now all over the place.
Uh-huh.
How do you perceive that... Is that like when the car odometer resets to zero, only there's still a car there?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm still sitting in the car. It's just got 100,000 miles on it.
Right. For me, and maybe this might be different for different people, but the fact that we're having this conversation right now, to me, is like the fact that we're symbols of each other, in a sense. That if really we're all one being, then the Lance-ness and the Bruce-ness, if you will, and all the listeners out there, the your-ness, your personality-ness, if you will, are all just parts of the hologram that when we enjoy each other's presence, what we're really acknowledging is that the essence of what we are is beyond space-time, but the persona and the bodies and all the little dramas that go on, that's just a reflection or a shadow or a symbol, really. We're walking symbols of aspects of our consciousness. And as a one aspect of that, if you think of the seasons changing, like going from winter to summer, we're getting close to the spring equinox in a week or two, right? So, that transition point, we can think of as a time when we go from more dark to more light. Well, the timing is very apropos for maybe for those who have chosen to put their priorities toward waking up and, you know, emphasizing reality over falsity, maybe that is a kind of like a milestone or you know, a point on the road, so to speak, that could be indicative of a transition. But like you say, it isn't necessarily that suddenly it jumps from one thing to another. It could be more of a smooth gradation. Suddenly you notice, oh, I'm predominantly more in this realm of this thought system rather than the other one.
And then, of course, conversely, for those fragments of consciousness that might resist or be more aligned in an egoic manifestation or in a negative polarity, it might be a rougher ride.
Perhaps.
Or it might be a smooth ride. I don't know.
Uh-huh. And as you're saying that, it occurs to me that one of the things I was experiencing this weekend, and I've been doing this more and more, and it was just a great opportunity, traveling from where I live in Southern Oregon down to San Francisco, and then taking the rapid transit trains in and walking through the streets of San Francisco.
Well, I miss San Francisco.
Oh, it's a fun place. I grew up not far from there, and I was on the BART trains, as they call them. There was a couple empty seats across from my friend Mike and I, and at one point I was doing this sort of visualization. It's like, what if, like in some of Richard Bach's books, who I also admire, we were able to tune into our future selves, and this is kind of fitting into the context of Gary Renard's work.
Okay.
Is what if our future selves were sitting across from us and were whispering little guidance, you know, kind of like that GPS metaphor again, and moment to moment saying, oh, well, look this way, look that way. And as I was looking around at the other people on the train, I was realizing we all appear to be having different issues and different, you know, awarenesses and experiences and so forth. But on the deepest level, we're all the same being. And so that awareness not only has a theoretical aspect that is wonderful and can be comforting, but a very practical one, too, because then if you approach everyone you meet with the idea that this is the most important being in the universe, who has all the wisdom within them, then your approach is one of incredible compassion and tolerance and appreciation, because you realize that everyone has a gift for you, and that gift can then translate into what we would call that quantum forgiveness, because you know, we're then prompted within that thought system or that frame of mind to release the idea that there's something to be upset about with whoever we happen to be with.
Right.
And it does take practice, but it's not necessarily easy, but it's simple.
Is that related to the... I know these are all just words that I'm throwing around here, but is that related to the idea of Christ consciousness?
Absolutely.
Oh, good. Well,
yeah.
I got one right tonight.
I mean, yeah, and I think it's a great word. Unfortunately, you know, that's why I think this could kind of launch into the whole thing of form versus content, which again is back to cause and effect, because the form, you can use the form, and the, you know, like a circle can be a metaphor for wholeness and completeness, but if you get hung up in the form, then you're kind of forgetting it, and you're trying to make the illusion real, or trying to, you know, to fix the dream, you know, be dream repairman again.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, and
fixing the dream isn't going to cut it, you know.
And that takes a lot of energy.
Yeah, and it does. Oh, it does. It's an enormous drain on what we could be doing to be more effective.
Yeah.
And the irony is that, you know, when you know, again, to use what seems like a religious reference, that, you know, seek first the kingdom of heaven, or basically, in other words, dwell on the level of cause, and then you may not have the immediate effects that you're looking for, but when you're not attached to the outcome, you realize that's not where it's at. The fulfillment, the sense of fulfillment, comes from the actual trusting and letting go.
Letting
go of the wheel. To use another flying metaphor, when I was getting my pilot's license, my instructor said, one of my mentors, actually, who was an editor for Flight Safety Magazine for the Air Force, said, the plane knows far more about flying than you ever will. So if you have it, if you have the attitude gyro dialed in and the trim tabs and everything dialed in correctly, if you get in a bad attitude, and that's what it's called in a plane, you let go of the yoke, you let go of the wheel, and the plane will pretty much fly itself. And I think that's, a wonderful metaphor for the dashboard of our inner being, is that if we can let go of trying to do it ourselves with our finite, egoic, persona, body identification perspective, and let our transpersonal, you know, to use the words of course, Holy Spirit, true self, higher self, whatever, let that part of us that already has the complete database of insight and wisdom take over, then we're flying on autopilot with the inner guidance at the helm rather than trying to use the extremely limited space-time little fragment of understanding we again, all based on effect to try to guide us. So.
Well, that makes perfect sense to me, and in fact, that kind of ties into the idea that the world is not out there. The stars aren't up in the sky. They're all within us.
Bingo. Bingo. And for people who've watched What the Bleep,
yeah,
there's a physicist named John Wheeler, and he, I think, if I get this quote right, I think he said something like, there's no out there out there. And I love that because it's basically saying that, that everything that we see, including all the walking symbols we call other people and animals and plants and everything else that make up the so-called material world, are projections. They're part of the screen that we call our life. And the most challenging thing is to remember that moment to moment. And to train yourself to constantly bring to mind, not out of any kind of a frenetic panic mode, but like, oh, I think I'm going to be kind to myself and really enjoy the ride home, if you will, by not trying to do it myself and allowing the truly brilliant virtuoso guidance that is our true self take over the helm.
Well, now that brings up the next question. I know that there are a lot of different techniques and ways that we can do that, but I can just hear the listener saying, well, how in the heck do I do that?
Right.
I have to work two jobs. I have a kid to raise. My dad's in the hospital.
Right.
How do I find that inner guidance?
Well, we've all got the stories, right? I don't know anyone who doesn't have a story of some kind going on. I mean, I'm not demeaning or minimizing in any way all the things that we're up against or appear, as you said very beautifully earlier on this hour, appear to be, or seem to be, I think is the word you used, seem to be up against. And once you get that little crack in the wall behind which we've made this wall of guilt and pity and all that negative egoic stuff, all that stuff that we wrap around our story, that takes what's really nothing and then makes a big deal out of it.
Which is an avoidance system.
It is. And the moment we say, it, just even just allow a little bit of willingness to entertain the idea that, well, just maybe this story, there's room in it for my mind to be a little bit more aware that I could remember to, you know, have a little levity here and not take it quite so seriously. And I think humor is a hugely effective tool. And also just, you know, the compassion for ourselves and just say, okay, I've beat myself up enough. I've been there, done that, of trying to make the dream work, trying to patch the, you know, the holodeck. and instead of trying to change what's on the screen, if I go back to the projector and you know, work with what's going on to the film, I might be a bit more effective here. And then that is really truly an incredibly compassionate act, not only for yourself, but all the so-called others that are in your you know, realm of existence.
Well, and it's such a relief, too.
It is, because then you can say, okay, I'm off the hook. I don't have to worry about what to say, what to do. All I have to do is follow the guidance and look at the inner dashboard. Look at that dashboard that says, okay, am I tilt? Is my attitude off? Is my attitude gyro telling me that I need to, you know, listen to what someone is telling me and take what's being presented to heart and truly be compassionate by, A, not reinforcing the problem, but doing what can be done on the level of form to make changes. But even more importantly, to identify with the transpersonal or the eternal part of each person and say, okay, I truly want what's best for all concerned.
And
it's that perspective and that frame of mind or that thought system that allows us to go beyond our little petty grievances and say, okay, well, now what really could we do here? And that usually has very pragmatic results, because when you get your own interests, as we perceive them, out of the way, then the interest that really truly can benefit everyone come to the fore.
Well, I think another way of saying that is, you know, what I've noticed for myself is when I'm self-absorbed, then it seems like life is a basket of problems.
Oh, yeah.
Thinking about other people and truly putting myself in their place and trying to figure out what I could do to help that person, even if it's just a handing out some spare change to somebody who's homeless, in that moment, I'm transcending myself, and yet I'm being myself fully.
Right, right.
And, you know, if you could do that 24 hours, well, I guess Mother Teresa did, but I don't have a nun's habit on, so.
Yeah, and again, it's not about the level of form.
Right, right.
Because
right.
You may or may not want to throw a coin in the guy on the street
right.
corner's
that,
cup, but what you can do is, regardless of the external gestures or behavior, you can allow yourself to not add to the burden by making what appears to be real, and by reinforcing the guilt, if you will, the unconscious guilt that comes about by not looking at the dream as a dream.
Mm.
Yeah.
So that really requires a big step or shift in consciousness to move out of denial.
It does. It does. And it's interesting because one of the things in the Course in Miracles that are like says there's that what's called a proper use of denial. And again, that's kind of like the stereogram of looking past what appears to be. It doesn't mean that you discard what your senses are saying.
Mm-hmm.
You don't put tape over your glasses or cotton in your ears. You know, that's not what it's about at all.
Right, right.
It's really more about what is my internal representation of what the senses are telling me.
Mm-hmm.
And if we make a representation of something that we think is quote unquote bad, and we allow ourselves to feel wrapped up in the drama of that, then we're immobilized. We're truly immobilized to what we could do to be effective, number one. But even more importantly, we're forgetting that what's going on outside of us is not the reality. It's what's going on inside of us.
Mm-hmm.
That not only is what's real, but also what we have some choice moment to moment in how we direct it.
Mm-hmm.
And we can bypass a whole lot of distractions and detours by using that quantum technique of transpersonally connecting with our inner being, which is the same being as everyone else. And that's where the feeling of unity comes. So when you see someone who appears to be having problems, you can say, this is a gift for me because this means I'm having a healing opportunity to heal a part of myself. Again, with the capital S self that is really all where we're all one.
Mm-hmm.
Then, when we let go of the belief that we're separate, then there's a feeling of true connection that comes across, and regardless of what happens externally.
Yeah.
I mean, you may never say a word to a person, but internally, you can create the grease the skids for that awareness.
And that also creates a shift in the quote out there.
It does. It does.
But when you shift something within yourself, or make that connection, then it's as if the whole universe is somehow almost like throwing a rock in a pond.
Absolutely, the ripples that go out from every choice that we make. Another thing that I keep coming back to Course in Miracles because I just find it as a totally undiluted source of font of spiritual wisdom. And one of the things in there says that, something to the effect of all the kindnesses that you've ever expressed are never lost. And I think that's so true because anything that we've done from that truly altruistic, transpersonal perspective, every thought and every feeling that we've had that relates to the oneness that we are and the joyousness and the freedom that really is our true nature, that is never lost. All the fun that we've ever had, truly, is eternal. It may have taken forms that seem to come and go, but the peacefulness that is the residual, we have that forever.
Mm.
Yeah.
Do you obviously you feel that we continue in consciousness as when we step out of this body,
the next
world or worlds beyond this, yes?
Sure. Oh, sure. I mean, it's like saying, well, okay, I'm going to take off one outfit and put on another.
Right.
In fact, in one of the study groups in Ashland, close to where I live, I just happened to be there on Halloween, and I was talking about this to the group I was just at yesterday. happened to be there on Halloween, and so when we went to Egypt years ago, we got these galabayas, which they wear there, and I thought, well, that's an easy costume to put on. And then I had a chuckle on my way over. I was thinking, well, I'm dressing up for Halloween, but aren't we all every day? Because truly, you know, we put on the costume that we call our bodies.
Yeah.
And we say, oh, this is me. Well, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Come on now. I mean, I think any time we really look from a metaphysical level the total folly of identifying with our bodies and everything that they do with, you know, have to deal with, it's ludicrous.
Yeah.
And so when I've got a little thing that, you know, I have on my mirror from one of Gary Renard's books, and it's, you know, I am a mortal spirit. This is just this body is just an image. It has nothing to do with what I am. And so that's my
I like
combing
that.
My hair, shaving mantra as I'm standing in front of the mirror. And it's fun because when you look at the physical so-called reality, and you can laugh at it a little bit. And the other phrase that I've kind of been using lately is dream hero action figure. A place toward the end of the text in the Course in Miracles that talked about the hero of the dream. And if you think about it, you know, what we do during the day is we take these little space-time things we call our bodies, and we move them around, and we do all these things that we think are so important, but it's really nothing more than kids playing with little action hero figures, you know, posing them in certain positions and making them do all these lifelike things, you know. But it's not real life, it's just the hologram that we made up.
Yeah. Well, how do you account for those who one might consider truly evil or controlling or wanting to take over the world? You know, how does that reconcile into, because there does seem to be a dark shadow aspect to creation.
Right. Could that be just, again, if we go back to the idea of that everything is a symbol, could that be a part of us that we haven't forgiven?
Oh, yes.
You know, could it be something that we and again, that I think the challenge is to not make the effect real, but to bring what appears to be back to the light of that transpersonal understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Course, it talks about bringing the darkness to the light. But we can't do it by ourselves. If we try to do it with our own, you know, space-time understanding, it's going to be a flop from the get-go. Because, you know, we just don't have, with our limited understanding, that presence to resolve it. But if we ask for help and ask for that guidance and say, okay, what does this mean? And get in the habit of trusting that guidance, that, you know, whether it's, you know, pick your favorite saint, you know, Nisargadatta or Jesus or Buddha or, you know, Mother Teresa, you know, whoever. I mean, whoever works for you as an embodiment of those principles of integrity and spiritual genius or whatever you want to call it, you know, it doesn't matter. I mean, you pick someone that works for you. Yeah, or not, doesn't even have to be a person, but just the idea of that transpersonal insight and muse, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then draw on that.
Mm-hmm.
And I do that as well as more and more tuning into the people on our local study groups. And kudos to all of them who might be listening to that. and it's fun because I'd say, oh, I think of all the people in our groups, and it's like, oh, you're all there supporting me and holding this thought system, which is really true, and then dissolving away. And so together we're bringing the darkness to the light. And when you do that, when you bring what is the illusion to the light, it dissolves. But if you try to take, you know, the truth and bring it down to the level of form, it's never going to work.
That's right.
It never cuts it.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, by the time you get the truth and you try to translate it into the dream world, it's just, no, it's not going to fly.
It doesn't work, does it?
No matter how much we try, no matter how many rolls of duct tape or how many yards of baling wire and chewing gum, you know, we're not going to make patching up the hologram or the dream world work. And countless lifetimes we've tried.
It sure seems that way.
Doesn't it?
Does that account for the belief systems that people are trying to shove down each other's throats? And
of course,
each other's
of course, yeah. And that's one of the commonest distractions of the ego is again, it's called projection.
Right.
We take what we don't want to look at in ourselves, we put it out there in the form of some other person.
Right.
So it can be, you know, our life partner, it can be the people we work with, it can be family members, it can be, you know, the guy on the street corner, it can be whatever. It doesn't make any difference. But the beauty of it is we don't have to resolve all of that unconscious guilt at once. All we have to do is moment to moment look at what's in front of our face and forgive our misperception of that. And that's, it's not always easy, but it's simple. You know, when we put it back into the terms of, do I want to be right or happy? Do I want to, you know, hold on to this grievance about something that really isn't there?
Right.
In the cosmic scheme of things.
Right. And it's just taking up space.
Or just let go of it and be free.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's so liberating when we remember to do that. And I think that's what we're really all here for, is to help each other remember. Because I get a lot of strength from, you know, friends and colleagues. And, you know, even on the LinkedIn and Facebook and MySpace and all, it's like, you know, there's so many mechanisms that we have now. And, of course, now we're streaming this on the web. And we have so many tools to help each other remember.
Mm-hmm.
And I happen to have fun with geometric ones, because I think there's some shapes that just like anything else, with the right thought system, we can bring ourselves to remember. It's like, oh, anything can be a reminder, a mnemonic for going home to that remembering that we've never been separate. We've never been apart.
I just love everything you're saying. And some people have likened some of the places that they go in their out-of-body experiences to geometric forms.
Sure, sure.
So they could be constructs for, you know, just about anything, I would think.
Yeah, what I kept coming to, because as you mentioned in the intro, which is kind of fun because I'm thinking, wow, I've had a lot of fun, done a lot of exploration since I put that little intro that you read together. But it's still true, because I think the geometric metaphors can be a way of, just like anything, so you can use music, poetry, you know, the fragrance of a beautiful bouquet of flowers, I mean, or somebody's smile, it just flashes by as you're walking down the street.
Yeah.
Anything can be a mnemonic for that thought system that says we're all interconnected. And so geometry, I think, is a neat one, because there's so many metaphors, like a circle that has every point is equidistant on the perimeter of a circle.
Mm.
So there's no preference, in the same way that when we let go of attachment to outcomes, there's no preference for any point in space-time.
Mm-hmm.
It's all the same. The illusion, the effect on the screen of our lives, it's all the same. There's no order of difficulties, as A Course in Miracles would say. It's all equally hilarious to our transpersonal selves to make a big deal out of nothing.
Okay, well, now I have another question for you.
And it isn't always easy. It isn't always easy. But the more we practice it, the easier it is to remember.
Well, I'm going to have to. I started The Course in Miracles a long time ago, and I didn't finish it. So maybe this is a book. This is something I need to read.
Well, it may not be for everyone, you know, because a lot of people get a lot of things out of it, a lot of wonderful things. And I think it's what's challenging, and it's probably actually the most radical thought system of all, because it's basically asking us to look at what we consider reality, consensus reality. Uh-huh. And question the very foundation of it.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's vital.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about, because you have spent time in the Great Pyramid.
Uh-huh.
And you've played music there, as a matter of fact. And
uh-huh. A little.
You studied there. And what, now those are clearly, that's part of our consensus reality.
Right.
And what's the feeling about what they're there for? What are they there to tell us? And,
well, that could be another whole hour. Maybe we could
we'll
do that as a follow-on. But just real briefly, I'm convinced that one aspect of the pyramids is as a reminder that there's more than one dimension. I mean, the experience that I had when I was in that uppermost publicly accessible chamber called the so-called King's Chamber,
mm-hmm.
not that there was necessarily ever a pharaoh entombed there, even though that's the common belief. Anyway, the granite box that they call a sarcophagus, while toning in there, along with my friends who were joining me on the trip we went with Greg Braden in 92, the experience I had was that of a thousand-voice choir singing through me.
Huh.
And that's the best I can describe it. And
and
the way I would relate to that is it's really no different than, you know, when we are sharing something that we're really inspired about, and this past hour has been a pretty good example for me.
And just
you know, the fact that you have your wonderful zany mystical attitude that we can share and hopefully resonate with some of your listeners. That transpersonal awareness that we really are one being.
Yeah.
That took on for me in that moment in the pyramid. the semblance of an experience of, you know, voices through me. But it's, in a sense, what I realized at that point is you don't need the physical structure. I mean, sure, if you feel like going to, you know, sacred sites and making those pilgrimages, more power to you. But the lesson I got, in the kind of the same way that sacred geometry has been, you know, been a wonderful stepping stone for me to realize that you don't need it.
Wonderful. Wow.
Because, well, you can use the tools and then let them go.
Right.
Another series of books that I read in high school I really loved, The Life and Teachings of the Master of the Far East. They were saying, you know, in there, when you ascend a staircase, you don't carry the stairs you've gone up on your back. You leave them for the next person, you know. I really like that because, like, you know, why try to burden yourself with what you appear to have learned when you can leave it for the next person?
And, wow.
And I think that the same thing is true with these certain experiences, that once we realize that the multidimensional nature of who we are and really beyond that is our true nature, then we don't need the circumstances. We don't need the specific or so-called special things or situations in space-time to use as a distraction for knowing that we can do it anywhere, anywhen.
Wow. Well, that's a perfect place to segue into the end.
Yeah. Well, thanks.
We walked the staircase up, and now we're ready to leave it there for others.
Yeah. And I love sharing this stuff, so, you know, by all means, you know, people want to check out the stuff on the website. I've got geometrycode.com, a lot of stuff on sacred geometry. And again, it's fun. I think it's you know, the shapes are not what's important. It's the meaning behind them, and really the meaning behind the meaning.
What's your other website, Bruce?
Well, several others. I've got one I've just started called ACIM Blog, which is a blog about A Course in Miracles.
Okay.
And got a few links there, and just barely started it, so it's really not much content there yet.
Okay.
And then my original blog, which is due for overhaul, BruceRawls.com, and that's RAWLES.
Wonderful.
And then there's a few other that my wife and I do, but I've got links at the bottom of the geometry code.
And you're still
code,
working on your second book.
Oh, yes, uh-huh. Yep, and if I can, more and more inspired all the time to get that finished, because I've got a lot of good content for that.
Well, wonderful. Yeah. Well, I'll have to have you back again, because
it
seems like we go all over the universe with together, and we're just starting to kind of get it, and then it's like it's time to go.
Yeah, well, I really enjoyed both of these interviews we've done now, and really thank you, Lance, for making the opportunity for us to share all this stuff.
Oh, thank you, Bruce. I can't thank you enough, and we'll do this again soon, okay?
Great. Thanks again.
All right.
Have a wonderful evening and a great weekend.
All right, you too.
Take care.
Good night.
All right, bye.